Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's March 6th, 2019. We have six matters on our calendar today. Marshall, will you call the first case? I'll go over just a few things, though I think you're both familiar with our rules. But each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I would remind you just to introduce yourself when you first come to the podium. And there's a tag on it if you want a little place you can raise or lower the podium if that helps. So whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. Rachel Bond representing the appellant D'Angelo Davis. Mr. Davis was convicted after a jury trial of two counts of second-degree assault with a dangerous weapon and a possession of a firearm charge. And in this direct appeal, the issues concern eyewitness identifications. And specifically, Mr. Davis is entitled to a new trial because the pretrial show-up identification procedure was impermissibly suggestive and because the district court erred in refusing to modify the pattern jury instruction on eyewitness identifications. I hope to get to both issues today. They sort of dovetail a little bit, but let me start with the show-up. This court is well aware of what the test is and that the ultimate question of whether a pretrial identification procedure is so suggestive that it violates due process is an issue that's reviewed de novo. Now, in this case, the district court correctly decided on that first prong of the test as far as the show-up procedure itself, that it was impermissibly suggestive as to the one witness. That is a correct finding. Where the district court erred on prong one is that the show-up procedure was also impermissibly suggestive as to the second witness. And what's unusual in this case that, frankly, I don't see factually in any of the other cases from this court is that we have this police procedure wherein both witnesses are exposed to a degree of information from the police, inadvertently, I would say, but nonetheless, both at the time of the scene, at the incident, and during this long 40-minute drive to the scene of the show-up, these witnesses are exposed to information that taints their identifications because they understand that the person that they are being shown is the person who the police believe to be the suspect. And that is so because these witnesses here, we found the car. One of the witnesses knows that the police have followed the car or found the car way over in this other section of Duluth. So they know already that the person they're going to view is associated with the car that they saw at the scene.
As to prejudice, there's no dispute, is there, that your client was attached to the car, that the car was your client's?
I think that's true, yeah, as to prejudice. That could be part of the reasoning on the prejudice prong. You know, I think there is no question in this case, frankly, that these eyewitness identifications played an extremely strong part in the case. They are the subject of the closing arguments by both lawyers. We have not just one eyewitness ID, but two, and that is emphasized quite strongly by the prosecutor in the closing. We have the general recognition in the case law that there are few things as powerful as an eyewitness identification as far as the impact on the jury. So just because there was some other evidence, but the prejudice prong is not a sufficiency of the evidence question. It's an impact on the verdict question. And we have these two eyewitness identifications, both of which were tainted, both of which were unduly suggestive, and neither of which are restored under that second prong to a sufficient degree of reliability because of application of those five factors.
This what concerns me, going back to Judge Ross's question, Ms. Bond, is it's not only do we have the Cadillac with the plate number because connected with your client, but also that you had the black assault rifle with a scope. So, I mean, between those two things and this romantic relationship, I suppose, too, you know, how does that not kind of overcome the what I understand you're saying is perhaps some unnecessarily suggestive show up?
Well, again, to the extent that's a prejudice question, a harm question, I would agree there is other evidence that the jury heard that connected my client to the charged conduct. But that is not the focus of the closing argument, number. And so I think the question for this court, if we are on harm, is how do we know, can we know that this error was harmless or beyond a reasonable doubt? And that's a high standard. And when you look at the power of eyewitness identifications, the fact that we have two, the fact that it was such a focus of the closing argument, the question is not, if we take away those two suggestive IDs, is there a sufficient evidence for a verdict? That's not the question. The question is, did the admission of those pretrial identifications and then the in-court identification that flowed from them, do we know beyond a reasonable doubt that that did not impact the verdict? Absolutely not.
Were these two witnesses the only ones who identified your client at trial?
Yes. So that's, you know, there is this sort of, there's this stuff in the police reports and the state relies on it a little bit that there were these other witnesses at the scene and that provided some connection to the car and the license plate.
And didn't one of those witnesses actually have a picture of your client on a Facebook page?
They did. That's not evidence that the jury heard. So that, you know, we can't, that doesn't.
Just one of the show up witnesses see that Facebook page, or did both of them see that?
Just one. And that fact, so number one, that evidence wasn't heard by the jury, and so that can't count as far as neutralizing the harm. Number two, the fact that that's what one of those witnesses heard works in my favor because that taints the procedure even more. So we've got this, you know, again, and I don't, it's not necessarily a...
How do we use that if that wasn't introduced at trial? What do we make of that evidence?
I'm pretty sure it wasn't introduced at trial. If opposing counsel corrects me, and I'll stand corrected, but I don't believe the Facebook evidence was introduced at trial. So how it is relevant for this court is the only way it is relevant is to what role did that have on the identification procedures. And the district court makes reference to the fact that before that one witness gave his identification, his description to the police at the scene, this other woman, this witness at the scene, approached him and said, "Isn't it this guy?" And then the witness said, "Oh yeah, it's that guy." So that's one way that his...
So how did that get into the record for the district court to be using it?
It's part of the discovery. So it's captured in the police reports and the body cams, and the prosecutor for the pretrial suppression issue submitted all of that information to the district court for consideration of the suppression motion. So the district court refers to it in its factual findings just as part of the facts. And I think it does provide, again, it does provide a link in the sense that the police had this information from a couple of other witnesses that led them to try to locate the car. The state uses the significance of that to say this was merely a confirmatory identification, so we don't need to worry about the suggestiveness of it. And they rely on the Taylor case for that. And that, respectfully, is, I think, completely wrong. In Taylor, the victim it's the victim herself who is exposed to this very suggestive show-up procedure. The reason why in Taylor that was merely confirmatory is because this witness had given her own two prior identifications. She said, "Oh, here's the guy that assaulted me is X, and I know him because he lives in my building." And so in that case, sure, that last suggestive show-up really was just confirming her own prior identifications. But these two witnesses didn't make initial identifications of the defendant. They didn't say, "Oh, I knew who that is, that's Davis."
So which of the mosaic of cases that we have on this or related issues of suggestibility do you think most closely mirrors this case?
You know, I don't know that there is a case. I think this is sort of the problem when you have an issue like this that's so fact-specific. It's hard to find a case that falls right on all fours. You know, I do rely on some of the cases I cite as far as the suggestiveness of a one-man show-up, and those I cite quite a few of those in my brief. I don't necessarily disagree that the Nunn case, the N-U-N-N case, is factually similar in the sense of there's some conduct, there's some criminal conduct, there's a fleeing the scene, somebody calls in a plate, and then they're brought back. I don't think that case is particularly helpful for the state in that we don't have the kind of facts in that case that we do here, which is these two witnesses being exposed to so much information from the police. So I guess I can't, Judge Ross, point you to a specific case that is on all fours factually, but that doesn't mean I lose, because there are so many cases, as set out in my brief, that clearly establish what we're concerned about is reliability of these pretrial identifications. This was an unduly suggestive identification. I think there's...
I'm still trying to understand, though, what we're supposed to do with this information. It seems to me that one of the witnesses, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding the facts, actually looked at the picture on Facebook and said, yes, that's him. That same witness then was taken, and he said, yes, that's him. How is that not a confirmatory identification?
Well, because the only way I think it would be a confirmatory identification if the witness at the scene said to the police, without being tainted by this other person's very suggestive showing
on
him
the
a
Facebook
correctly
the showed up with the Facebook page.
Correctly. Okay. So if the witness had said to the police, I know who it is. I know who it is because I'm Facebook friends with him, or I've seen him in the neighborhood, or I know who his girlfriend is, and it's Davis.
Okay, so you're saying the initial Facebook his identification on Facebook wasn't really his identification.
Absolutely not. I wouldn't even call it. Correct, Your Honor. I wouldn't even call it an identification. I don't know that the district court really did either. It's an agreement to another witness's suggestion that was the guy.
Right, but that's where it gets a little bit dicey, because the case law is pretty clear that there's no constitutional concern to the suggestion if law enforcement or the state is not involved. So if a bystander says, isn't this the person, and it somehow gets into the witness's head that that's the person, that's not a law enforcement constitutionally triggering event, is it?
No, and I'm not challenging the identification procedure where the witness agreed with the woman.
Right, but you were saying that, well, that one's tainted, so...
What I am saying is that fact, and I think that's sort of a minor fact, and I urge the court, frankly, not to get too distracted by that. It is not part of the district court's analysis very much. What we know from identification procedures is we care about, I guess I'll call it, the purity of the identification. We care about whether the witness has had extraneous information from someone else, whether it's the police or anyone else, that impacts their ability to independently make an identification from their own recall of what they saw. And there is no question here that before that witness gave his own initial physical description to the police, someone else had shown him a picture and suggested that that was the suspect. And that, I think, really where that goes to for me is under the five factors on prong two, how sure can we be that this identification was reliable because of a prior description?
Before you lose all of your time, I would like to have you address the other issue.
Yeah.
And from a big picture standpoint, I'm trying to get a sense of whether you believe, whether we're just sort of a placeholder so you can bring this upstairs, or whether you believe that we have the authority to deem the district court as acting in an abuse of the district court's discretion by following precedent that we've established and the Supreme Court has not reversed, and the Supreme Court has said only, well, we'll look into this.
Yes.
Do you really believe that there's an abuse of discretion if this is the information that's in front of, that we could hold that there's an abuse of discretion? I guess that's the first question.
Yes, I do. And here's why. The district court always, always has the authority to modify the pattern jury instructions. The pattern jury instructions are not the law.
Well, the district court has the authority to do so. So, I think I'd probably be on board if it were the other way around. And the issue was whether the district court abused its discretion by giving this instruction. But our question's different. Does the district court abuse its discretion by not giving the instruction?
I agree. I agree that that's where we are, and I agree, and we are. And I mean, I will put my cards on the table. If this court finds no abuse of discretion, I do think the Supreme Court thinks, I mean, you know, based on its report, and I'm glad counsel supplemented the record with the order. The report is attached to the order. I think this court can take judicial notice of it. I do think the law needs to change. I do think the law is stagnant in Minnesota on this issue, and it is stagnant in a manner that disadvantages the accused. And that, I think, is actually pretty clear. So why is there no, so if you find no abuse of discretion, absolutely. I hope you do so in a manner, frankly, that lets me tee it up, that tees it up for a petition for review. But there is an abuse of discretion in this case, and to sort of finish the discussion, the problem is that at the time the district or the defense submitted its request for the jury instruction, I believe it was undisputed that there is a factual, legal, and scientific basis for that request.
But the jury's not aware, as I understand it, there was no testimony to the jury to explain the relationship between cross-racial identification and reliability or handgun in the face or rifle in the face reliability. So how would the instruction not have just confused the jury? How would the jury have been able to determine whether the gun affected the accuracy of the identification or whether race affected the accuracy of the identification without that sort of testimony?
Well, I mean, this is a little bit leads to my disagreement with the Thomas opinion. I think it is recognizing that that's precedent for this court. I think it is wrong to say that expert witness testimony is required before a jury is instructed on some of these issues. We instruct juries on all kinds of complicated, scientific, all kinds of things, and they do, and we instruct them without expert testimony.
Right,
so number one. Number two, the Thomas opinion does say at the time the request was made in that case, it was without any factual support. What we have in this case is a witness, both witnesses saying, I was really focused on the gun. May I just finish my sentence?
Yes, and then I have another question.
Okay. We also have a witness saying, boy, I have trouble telling how old black people are. I can't tell them apart in that manner. So we have a factual basis in this case that did not exist in the Thomas case. We also now have, to the extent Thomas rested on this idea that we don't have any Minnesota studies that back up the need for this kind of instruction, well, we do now. And I think what's important is that neither the state nor the district court has ever challenged the requested instruction on the basis that it would not have been helpful, that those weren't relevant facts in this case, that the social science is not solid. Instead, they said, it's not my role to change the jig. That's an abuse of discretion.
One final question. Earlier you said that, you know, that assuming that we were going to rely on Thomas and not kind of overrule that, you would ask us to tee this up in a way that you could take it to this Minnesota Supreme Court. Do you want to illuminate us on what you meant by that?
Well, in my experience,
what do you want us not to say?
In my experience, the quickest way to let me get up to the Supreme Court is to rule in my favor. I think what would be helpful if I were to lose on that basis is for this court to recognize, echo some of what was said in the Evidence Committee's report, recognize that the Birch case that found this instruction adequate is 50 years old, that social science has advanced and everyone recognizes that these factors are important and should be incorporated as part of the pattern jury instruction. And I think the other thing that might be helpful, and frankly, I think this is true, is that we are in this holding pattern of district courts think they need to wait for the Supreme Court to act. This court is bound as an error-correcting court to an abuse of discretion. The Supreme Court needs to change the law. And again, it is critically important because we have criminal defendants losing their liberty over unreliable eyewitness identifications.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court, my name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing this morning on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The due process test here has two prongs, but I really want to emphasize the second prong, the reliability prong, because I think the circumstances of this case are quite persuasive in showing that there can be no doubt that the witnesses reliably identified Mr. Davis. And the most important fact on that second prong is the remarkably accurate and detailed description of the vehicle that the suspect vehicle that AB provided.
But anybody could be driving that vehicle.
I don't believe there's any indication that anybody could be driving it. I guess theoretically, yes, it's possible. But here we have a situation. The hood of the vehicle was warm when the officers encountered it. The front door was open, and Mr. Davis was at the residence associated with that vehicle based on the registration, and he was leaving that residence with the registered owner.
What does the front door being open tell us about anything?
I'm sorry, could you repeat
that? What does the front door being open lend to our understanding of what happened?
That it was used recently, and whoever was using it exited in a rush because perhaps they were trying to hide a firearm.
And so how does that tie to the defendant?
Because it's the defendant's car. It's undisputed that this is his car.
I understand that, but I guess, how does it tie to the defendant to the exclusion of others who might have been driving the car?
He told the officers, and this should be in the police reports that were in front of the district court, that nobody else had been driving it that day. There was a reference to a mechanic. It was sort of there was a shifting account of whether the mechanic had driven it. But other than that, Mr. Davis said no one else had been using it. He said, I don't let other people drive the car.
Can you speak to the focus that Ms. Bond refers to in the closing argument? I mean, when we consider prejudice, don't we weigh the weight that the prosecutor was giving the evidence? I know you're pointing to other things now, but explain whether you believe that the points you're making now were emphasized at closing argument.
The identity was certainly a big part of closing argument. We don't dispute that. But I think the other facts that were admitted during evidence really show that there can be no doubt that Mr. Davis committed.
I'm trying to get a sense of what the prosecutor emphasized. I haven't read the closing argument on this point, so I'm not sure. So I'm an open book as to whether you believe that the prosecutor emphasized these points that you're making now as opposed to emphasizing the eyewitness identification.
I think the focus was the eyewitness identification, and I want to be clear, the reason I'm focusing on these other facts, the car and some other facts that I will address, is because those are the facts that were before the district court when it admitted the evidence. And so I do want to disaggregate the idea of whether there was prejudice at trial versus the factors we consider in admitting the evidence. In terms of what the district court had in front of...
So you believe the focal point should be the moment of the admission of the evidence, not the weight the jury might have given to the evidence?
In terms of admissibility, yes, Your Honor. In part because this is a case where we have facts that the district court was aware of that were not presented at trial. The jury didn't even know all the facts that were relevant to determining whether this identification testimony was admissible. They're completely separate questions. And so, again, we have the AB giving a very detailed, accurate description of the vehicle. And the point is not that that establishes exclusively that Mr. Davis is the only possible person who could have used it, but it goes to the reliability of the identification because we have a witness giving a very specific license plate number and the physical characteristics of the vehicle that are associated with that license plate number match exactly the physical characteristics that he described. So we know that he's giving a very reliable account of what he saw.
So that tells us he was paying attention.
It tells us it was paying attention, but it's also just one of these really persuasive facts. It really shows that the reliability of this is pretty unimpeachable because, again, we have a person who's able to give an exact physical description of a vehicle. On top of that, we have the statements of the two teenage girls on scene that were not presented on trial. They identified the suspect as having a nickname, which just so happened to incorporate Mr. Davis's last name. They also identified the romantic interest of the person they saw with the gun as being with a female named Hope.
But why doesn't that taint the eyewitness identifications that we're looking at? Because the witness that you're talking about, who knew so much about the car, they said this is what was, and then he confirmed that after they identified the person.
Your Honor, the point is taken that they brought that to the witness, and that you know, you can see how that could have an influence on a witness's memory, but the courts are very clear that when the problem, the taint, does not derive from the law enforcement procedures, that is not a due process concern.
Right, so, but I think what Ms. Bond is arguing is we sort of have this double taint here, where he was influenced by information that made his original identification, the Facebook confirmation, of questionable reliance. And then on that, you have the law enforcement involved eyewitness identification that that was also suggestive in the way that it was marshaled.
The point is taken, Your Honor, but I'm not aware of any authority that says if it's sort of a mixed influence between non-law enforcement sources and law enforcement sources that we're going to take account of both of them. I've only seen cases that say if it doesn't derive from law enforcement, it's not a due process concern. But again, I'm getting the sense a little bit from the questioning that we're sort of mixing the two questions under the due process standard. The identification procedure, whether that was tainted, whether it was unnecessarily suggestive, and we don't think it was under Taylor, but then the separate question of looking at the rest of the circumstances, whether the identifications were reliable. And again, I think the facts that I've identified, in addition to the gun, show that this is a reliable identification. These are strong facts, and I don't think there's any way to conclude that Mr. Davis is not the person who committed this crime.
Doesn't your reliability argument really go to the I think his initials are AB, who said, you know, yes, it was a bronze Cadillac, and here's a license plate. But the other witness, who's also relied upon, is that you can refresh my memory in the closing argument, his identification as well didn't even get the type of car correct, right?
The color.
Right.
Well, I mean, this is a matter of degree. As I note in the brief, he described a metallic colored luxury sedan vehicle.
Didn't he say silver?
Mercedes?
Yes, he said a Mercedes and silver. Again, it's a metallic-colored luxury vehicle. But he also said, he clarified his comment, he said, or something like that type. And he said, but my friend, AB, who's a mechanic, he'll be able to give you an exact description of the car. So this is a witness who's acknowledging he doesn't have the best knowledge of the type of vehicle he's talking about.
This struck me as unusual in the length of time from the scene to the residence of the defendant and the amount of time. I mean, usually with these drive, the show up or the drive up, whatever, the one person identifications, they're so close in time, it just is impractical to have a photo lineup or something equivalent to a multiple suspect lineup. And it struck me as I was troubled by the fact that so much time elapsed, and with modern technology, it wouldn't seem to be very difficult, since the defendant is being detained by police, that a quick photo lineup couldn't have been marshaled, even digitally, electronically these days. I imagine it could be done in a matter of minutes.
A couple of points, Your Honor. Yes, the drive over was long. I think that reading the record, that was completely unanticipated. They're talking on the way over, they're discussing about how surprised they are about how long it's taking. But secondly, in terms of alternative methods of identification, maybe an officer on scene could have taken a picture of Mr. Davis and sent it to one of the officers, but that would have been problematic too, because then you have a single photo array.
Not necessarily. You could have a quick photo. That's what, with modern technology, photographs could be available at the touch of a finger and even off-site, someone can see his photograph and assemble several other photographs and present them digitally to a witness. I'm concerned more about the drive over also. You've got, if you're a witness in the back of a squad car, or sitting in the front seat of the squad car, and you know you're going to a place where the police have in custody someone of interest, it seems to me the longer, maybe disabuse me if you think I'm wrong about this, but the longer the drive, the more invested it would seem to a witness that the police are in the confidence that this is the one.
Again, the point is taken, Your Honor. I'd like to say two things. Going back to the opportunity to present a photo array, a digital photo array, I think that would take some time. I mean, ideally, we want those things to be double blind.
And that's not really our standard anyway. Even if we can say that, you're right, even if we could say there was a better way,
right,
that's not our legal standard. But I wanted to point out.
But it was so troubling. In terms of I'm sorry, in terms of the ride over, yes, you're with the police, you show up, there are police there. That's inherent to the one-man show-up itself, separate apart from the time element, the amount of time it takes.
You agree it's accentuated with the time element.
I think it could.
The longer you're with the police, the more the police seem to be invested in this person being the right guy.
I could see that. You know, I think if you're being taken by the police somewhere and there are police there, which is inherent to one-person show-ups, the time factor I don't think is going to sway somebody's memory. Perhaps it could. On top of that, I think the alternative, we see this in the Nunn case, where the police actually take custody of somebody, they bring them to the witness, and marshal the witness into the store in the Nunn case. That strikes me as far more suggestive, because now you have somebody in handcuffs. In Taylor, the man was in handcuffs. In Nunn, I don't know if he was handcuffed, but he was certainly in custody. That strikes me as far more suggestive than taking the witnesses to the person. And I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No,
go ahead.
Finish your sentence.
I think I was finished.
Okay. I want to move to a different factor, and that deals with the degree of confidence. You know, both these witnesses testify, they're 100% certain in their identifications. But I think Ms. Bond points out in her briefs that, you know, if we look at it today, there's a lot of social science that says there's really no statistical relationship between the accuracy of identification and this degree of certainty. You don't respond to kind of some of those social science arguments, but I'd like you to, because isn't that something that we should take into consideration when we're looking at the degree of confidence?
I'm not sure that this court can in this case, because the degree of certainty is generally presented in the precedent from the U.S. Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court, in terms of what the witness represents about how certain they are.
Have to take them at their word. We don't take note. We can't weigh that considering this pretty undisputed social science.
I think in terms of weighing it against the social science, we would then get into the area of whether this is actually a factor we should be looking at. And I understand the concern with the social science. I haven't thoroughly reviewed enough to say whether I disagree with it or not. I suspect I don't. But the factor is how confident is the witness. And if a witness says, both witnesses say immediately, I'm 100% confident, I think that's the factor the courts have instructed this court to look at. Just very quickly on Thomas and whether it can be distinguished on the facts. I would like to point out that in Thomas, I want to be a little careful because I was an attorney of record on Thomas. The description of the suspect in Thomas was not 100% accurate. He described the hat from a Chicago team, a Chicago athletic team, but the person was wearing a hat from another team. The trial evidence there, and this is recounted in the briefing on that case, it is that there was another person who was wearing the hat that the victim described. And so in terms of the facts, the factual recitation in the published Thomas decision don't recount all the facts, but there was a question about whether he had actually identified the right person. There's no question in this case that the victims identified the correct person. And again, for all the reasons I've explained, the gun, the vehicle, the romantic interest, and the nickname. And so I think that whether you get to harmless error or whether you're just looking at distinguishing Thomas on the facts, I think they're on all fours. And we would just ask this court to affirm Mr. Davis's convictions.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Unless the court has questions, I think I would raise
one. I do have a question just on Tom. Sorry.
That's all right.
You were trying to duck out of here. So it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, we would have to not just reach the jury instruction question as to whether this type of instruction is appropriate in the abstract. We'd also have to reverse Thomas's premise that if you don't get the instruction if there's no expert testimony supporting it, not just the facts, but actual expert testimony explaining to the jury what this instruction, how to apply the instruction, essentially. Would you agree with that?
I think that I think that from what, and I don't have the benefit of the knowledge of Thomas, the background of Thomas that opposing counsel does, from the opinion, I think that this court can distinguish it rather than overrule it on that factor, because the opinion really does say the request for that instruction, the cross-racial instruction, was made without any factual support and without a request for a hearing. So I do think this, I mean, it's a bit of a problem, frankly. I would refer to, you know, the Anderson case, which there was a special concurrence. I was the lawyer in Anderson, so I also feel that strongly. I would ask this court to, you can at least recognize that we have a different factual case than what existed in Thomas on that question of an expert testimony. So an expert on cross-racial identifications may really have been necessary in Thomas because there was not otherwise the kind of factual support that we have as we do in this case. And by that I mean not just all the social science and the National Academy report and everything else that was submitted to the district court, but we have a witness saying, I can't tell what age a black person is. We have some factual support in the record for instructing the jury that they can consider what impact a different race has on a witness's ability to do an identification. I think that is enough of a factual difference to say we can distinguish Thomas. I also,
Frank, the gun to the face.
There isn't anything in the Thomas opinion that talks about the request for the presence of the firearm instruction. So I also think that's an extra reason to say Thomas doesn't completely control the outcome of the request for the jury instruction.
I'm trying to get a sense of how a jury would be able to grapple with if told you can consider the gun or race when you're determining the accuracy and the reliability of the eyewitness identification without the studies to give all the support you're talking about for a jury to recognize, oh, these are problematic. Without that testimony, I don't understand how a jury would be able to assess apply the instruction to the facts.
Well, I guess I disagree with, as I've said, with Thomas and the notion that there has to be expert testimony for this formative instruction. I don't think there's very many other areas of the law where we require that. The idea is that we want juries to be fully instructed on the factors that they have to consider. And we instruct juries all the time on specific kinds of evidence and specific kinds of witness testimony. So I don't think that we need an expert for that. I think to the extent that, you know, frankly, Thomas is the law. I think that we can distinguish it. I think we can recognize that the legal landscape has changed a little bit, that we do have these studies now. And at the end of the day, my concern with Thomas, as I say in the brief, is that on this one issue, bizarrely, where there is an eyewitness identification case in a criminal case, criminal defendants are in this no-win situation. You can't get your jury instruction that fully informs the jury how to evaluate eyewitness identifications without an expert, but you can't get an expert witness either. And the result just is not only are juries not being fully instructed on what they need to know, but defendants are not getting a fair trial. So, I think there are ways to distinguish Thomas. If they're not, and I recognize how big an ask this is, I would ask this court to express some concern with the Thomas holding and go in a different direction. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. The matter was well briefed and well argued. We'll issue a decision within 90 days.